Hey, it's Craig. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to Canadian History X early and ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime. Greetings and welcome to another episode of Canadian History X. If you enjoy the podcast, you can support it for $3 a month. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX. You can also donate to the podcast by going to CanadaEHX.com and clicking Donate. Don't forget, I have two other podcasts out there, Pucks and Cups and From John to Justin, available on all podcast platforms. Today I'm speaking with Lorna Poplock, who recently wrote a book called The Dawn, which looks at the history of the Dawn Jail in Toronto. It's a really interesting book, and it's a really interesting history. And we talk about the jail, the characters within it, the escapes, and much more. So let's get right to the interview. Well, first question is, what inspired you to write the book on The Dawn?
I'd say that the first spark came when I was working on my first book. My first book was called Drop Dead, A Horrible History of Hanging in Canada. And at that time, I did a lot of research. I had a lot of stories about individuals, but I also had three stories on what I called, in fact, a whole chapter devoted to what I called my bricks and mortar characters. So those were institutions, prisons, and because it was about hanging, they were obviously prisons where hanging or jails, where hanging took place. So top of the list for me was the Don Jail. Firstly, it was in my city, it is in my city. Secondly, it was really top of the list, you know, one of the most awful institutions. And quite a few hangings took place there over the years. In fact, between 1872 and 1962, there were 34 men hanged in the Don Jail. So that really piqued my interest, and I started doing more research, and obviously I wanted to write up on the Don Jail, and I found all sorts of interesting facts about it. I found, for example, that it took 6 years to build. So, I mean, why should it take that long? It really did seem a long time. You know, one would think 1 year, 2 years, perhaps. It took 6 years to build. I found out also that about 4 years in, there was a fire in the jail. So that was really interesting. And, you know, they had to kind of start. It was a really serious fire. And of course, the insurance money didn't cover. There were all sorts of facts that came out. And then I went down to the jail because it's in my city and I live maybe about 30, 40 minutes away from it. And I walked down and I went into the library, and the librarian took me on a tour of the Don Jail, because the library that I'm talking about is actually the Bridgepoint Library. So the Don Jail is actually part of the Bridgepoint complex now. It's the administrative building for Bridgepoint. So, you know, it's come a long way since those early days when it was just on an outpost all alone outside the city in Toronto. So anyway, the librarian took me on a tour and she introduced me to people, and you know, I had contact with these people over time. They provided me with more information, with images, and I was just snagged. And then everything, you know, I was writing another book at the time, so I put this aside in a sense. And then it seemed as if a lot of other factors, you know, every time I turned somewhere, I would find something which was associated with the Don Jail. You know, I walked into St. James Cemetery, for example. I was walking through St. James Cemetery, which is just on Parliament Street in Toronto, downtown Toronto. And as I was walking along, I passed a grave marker, and I went to look at the grave marker, and I saw that it was the marker of William Thomas. He was the architect of the Don Jail. So there were all these things that were just kind of nudging me and, you know, kind of insisting that maybe this was something that I needed to take a look at. And here I am.
You mentioned 1962. It seems like it's right around the time with the last two hangings in Canadian history. Was that actually at the Don Jail, that the last two hangings?
Yes, those were at the Don Jail. Yeah. Okay. Those were Ronald Turpin and William Lucas. Oh, gosh, his first name. Arthur Lucas, I'm sorry. Ronald Turpin and Arthur Lucas. So they were hanged back to back in the jail. And just before their hanging, in fact, you know, one of the lawyers came around and said, you'll probably be the last ones to hang. And Turpin, who had a kind of a strange sense of humor, said, well, you know, that's a real consolation. But in fact, they were. That was in 1962, mm-hmm. but it took till 1976 before capital punishment was abolished in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Dawn, it was what made it so different in its time, that it was a different type of jail?
What made it different? So the Dawn Jail was built in, it was started in, excuse me, it was started in 1858. It was finished in 1864. So the Dawn Jail was actually the fourth jail built in Toronto. Well, I suppose technically you'd say it was the second jail built in Toronto because the first two were built in the town of York. So the city of Toronto was incorporated in 1834. So the first two jails, the first was in 1800, built in 1800, the second one in 1824. So just to briefly tell you what these ones were like. The first one was a log cabin. It had 10 rooms. It had no heating initially. Eventually, I think that they put a little heater somewhere in the middle of the thing. It accommodated a whole slew of people, different kinds, men, women, children, debtors, people awaiting execution of their sentence or trial. So it was a real mishmash of people in there, and it was a log cabin. So the conditions were terrible, very drafty, very cold. The second one was a brick building, and this one was on King Street, just to situate it. It was on King Street where the King Edward Hotel is today. So it was right downtown, what we would call downtown today, but in a sense, the town was so small, it was like 10 blocks in those days. So, you know, it's kind of a little bit outside the town. The second one was also in that general area. That was a brick building. And that one was possibly slightly bigger, although historians at the time complained that it was very ugly. But also conditions were terrible in there. Some of the windows were broken. And again, there the inmates were sleeping on the floor, just on straw on the floor. There were no beds. In fact, I think it was only in 1851 that that inmates got proper iron bedsteads. Until then, they'd just be sleeping on the floor on straw. So that was the second one. The third one was on Front Street at Parliament, and it was right on the waterfront. Front Street then was in fact on the front. And that was also, you know, a terrible institution. And, you know, it had a wall around it. And there was if they needed, they would put the gallows up on the wall because hangings took place there as well. So those were the three. That one was built in 1840. So those were the three precursors. So by the time we got to the middle of the 1850s, the city and the province really felt that they needed another jail and a bigger one to accommodate the population, which by then was about 50,000 people. So they needed something bigger. This was their assessment. And when you look at what the jail was, it was really different. It was architect designed, and the architect who designed it was one of the prominent architects, William Thomas, in Toronto at that time. And it incorporated the new concepts, the new philosophies that had been in the ether for a while, the new reformist philosophies. For example, John Howard was one of the foremost. He was a Brit, and he was one of the foremost reformist, penal reformist. And he wrote a book in 1777. It was called The State of the Prisons in England and Wales. And he spoke about exactly that, what jails and prisons were like. And they were terrible places. The inmates or the prisoners were accommodated in big rooms, all higgledy-piggledy, men, women, children, debtors, no sanitation. And he mooted a whole new way of looking at things. He felt that prisons should be built in a certain way. For example, he even sort of dove into the architecture of prisons, where the site of prison, they should be outside. Jails and prisons should be outside the city, you know, in fresh air. That the actual prison should have cells rather than big rooms, because that protected the inmates more. And things like ventilation, sanitation, those were important to him. So this was a whole new sort of mood, a whole new flavor that was coming to corrections. And by the time the Don Jail was built in the time it opened in 1864, it incorporated these trends. And in fact, it was the first institution of its kind in British North America.
Now, it's described as, or was described as, like a palace for prisoners, but it was quite the opposite of that for anybody who had to be housed in there.
Yeah, so the palace aspect, it was regarded as a palace because, as I mentioned to you, it was architect designed, William Thomas, foremost architect, and it incorporated the latest trends in architecture, in penal architecture at the time. And it was a really monumental building. It was a fine looking building. It's got this wonderful facade. You and I are on a Zoom call at the moment, so you can see behind me this facade, which has kind of been cleaned up. If I move slightly out the way, you'll see, no, you can't see it, but there was an entrance, a very substantial entrance, big oak doors, and on the top of the entrance there was a keystone. So the facade was very monumental, 4.5 stories, administrative block in the center, and behind the administration section there was a rotunda, big, wonderful sort of soaring space, and on the side there were wings. And the wings were where the cells were. So the cells were arranged back to back along the center of the wings, and there were windows facing outwards. So there was a lot of light coming into the building, and this light was so important to the early reformers. So it really did seem to be a palace, and that was what it was described as. Unfortunately, that didn't last for very long. What happened was that very soon, some of the sort of basic precepts that had been built into the jail, for example, the jail, the cells were very small, because the thought behind that was that the inmates would only spend the nighttime in the jail. So they would have these little cells in the nighttime. They would be individual cells. They would be there. They would be able to sort of think about things, maybe repent at their leisure in silence. And in the day they would be doing other things. They would be working because the jail was built on the grounds of an industrial farm. So there was a farm. They should be planting peas and potatoes or in classrooms, perhaps. But unfortunately, as time went along and penal philosophies changed, what happened to the inmates changed as well. So instead of being able to go outdoors and sort of spend time working and doing sort of meaningful work, they found themselves spending more and more time inside. So at night they would be in the cells, and in the daytime they would be in the corridors. So as the city got bigger and bigger, and the inmate population got bigger and bigger as well, to, you know, sort of correspondingly, the jail just couldn't cope with it anymore. So it got overcrowded. And in fact, over the years, overcrowding was the main criticism leveled against the jail. Always, that it was overcrowded. The other big problem was sanitation, because you had these tiny little cells. I remember reading, in fact, I do mention it in the book. My book is called The Don, The Horrible History of Hanging in Toronto. I'm sorry. It's called The Don, The Story of Toronto's Infamous Jail. I was mixing my two titles up there. Anyway, so these cells, as I describe at one point in the book, a mayor described it as being the cell, as being so small, so narrow, that you couldn't back a fat horse into it. So you had these tiny little cells initially for one person, but as time went on and, you know, sort of overcrowding became the norm in the jail, you'd find two or perhaps even three people stuffed into each cell. So it was very overcrowded, and there was no sanitation in the cells at all. So the inmates would have night pails. So you can imagine, with the jail being overcrowded and people having to use pails in the night, it was terrible. So, you know, this was the smell, as it was described, was absolutely awful within the jail.
Now, tell me a bit about George Basher, or Basher.
Yeah, his full name was George Headley Basher. Now, when I came across that name and I realized that he had been the governor of the Don, you know, I scratched my head and I thought to myself, you know, nonfiction just gives you these things. It makes gifts of things like that. I mean, a name like George Headley Basher, you know, it just sort of suggested to me the type of person that he was. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that suggestion was correct. So George Headley Basher, whenever I think of him, I have to mention both his first names and his last name. George Headley Basher was born in England. So he was British born, and he came to Canada in 1913, originally to join the Toronto Police. But he enlisted during the war, and he rose through the ranks in the war. And eventually he emerged in 1918. And the last thing that he'd done during the war is that he had run a big prison in Rouen in France. So when he came back, he did come back to Canada, and the city and the province were looking for a governor. The last 2 years, there had been no governor between 1917 and 1919, this was. There'd been no governor at all. And the jail had been very ineffectually run. So they needed somebody, just a firm hand to sort of take the tiller at that point. And they found it in George Headley Basher. He was what they wanted. They favored returned soldiers. So he was a returned soldier. And by the end of the war, he was a major. And for 12 years, it was between 1919 and 1931, he ruled the jail with a very firm hand. So he took over when there was, you know, everything was very demoralized. And he had very firm views. He had firm views on punishment. For example, he believed in capital punishment. He wasn't so sure whether it should be by hanging. He told an inquiry once that he believed in capital punishment, but maybe there were other methods, but he didn't suggest what that might be. He was a firm believer in corporal punishment. So he called it strapping. So this was where inmates would be strapped with a wide belt, you know, a strap. So he believed in strapping, although he preferred to call it spanking. I'll leave a pause after that. And in fact, people were strapped at the Don Jail, you know, over time. In fact, originally, the methodology was whipping. In fact, I have a picture, a sketch in my book of an inmate being whipped in this wonderful rotunda where a sort of a movable scaffold had been set up. So he believed in spanking, and he later ended up at the Guelph Reformatory. He ran that for a while. And after he'd been there, he said that the inmates there, who he had strapped or spanked, actually thanked him because they said it put them on the right track. And he was a very firm disciplinarian, but to be fair to him, he did temper this with mercy. One anecdote that I can tell you is that at one point there was an Armenian man on death row, and there were no Armenian priests in Canada. And this man was very distressed. He went on a hunger strike. All he did was smoke, and he cried the whole time. So Basher actually reached out to Boston, I think, you know, to places in the States to see if he could find an Armenian church with a priest who could sort of give some kind of solace to this man. So, you know, there were the two aspects to him. Eventually, he left in 1931, and he went on to the Langstaff jail farm, which was just north of Toronto. And there it was said that he used to do his rounds on horseback, and he used to jump his horses over hedges as he was doing his rounds. And he went on to serve in the Second World War. After the Second World War, he ran the Guelph Reformatory, and then he became the Minister of Reform Institutions. But he came back to kind of oversee the jail in 1952, and that really turned out to be a low point in his career.
Why was it a low point?
Ah, okay. So the reason it was a low point was that in 1952, there were, in 1951 and 1952, were two very famous escapes from the jail. And both these escapes were by members of the Boyd Gang. And this was a gang of bank robbers who, you know, I would say that in the spectrum of violence, they were probably not the most violent, but they robbed banks, and they robbed banks using weapons. So, you know, they were serious criminals. Mm-hmm. So three of them ended up in the jail in 1951, and they escaped from the jail by sawing through the window. Subsequently, they met up with a fourth one. So their names were Edwin Boyd, Lenny Jackson, Willie Jackson. So Lenny and Willie were not, although they had the last name, they were not related. They were the ones, three of them, those were the ones that did the first escape, that escaped the first time. And then they met up with another man whose name was Steve Sushan, and they promptly started robbing banks again. And then, so that was, they escaped in towards the end of 1951. In early 1952, in March of 1952, Lenny Jackson and Steve Sushan were in a car, and this car was sort of flagged down by a couple of policemen, and Steve Sushan shot the policeman. This man's name was Eddie Tong, and he subsequently died. So now, in addition to being kind of quite serious bank robbers, these men were murderers as well. So eventually they were hunted down, they were put in the Don jail. This time they were in death row. So four cells in death row, and they were incarcerated in death row. And they escaped. They escaped from death row. They managed to get a key so that they could get out of their cells into the corridor in front of, you know, there was a corridor in front of these four cells. And they managed to get a saw, which was supposedly smuggled in by the lawyer, by one of these lawyers, although the man did deny that. And they sawed through the window, they escaped again, four of them this time. It didn't take long before they were apprehended, but this was what was happening in 1952 when George Bashir stepped in again. And he got involved, and he had made sure that the governor was one of his own men at this time. But that governor didn't perform very well, because the second jail break took place under his watch. So really, this wasn't a very high point in Bashir's career, but he did go on to serve, you know, sort of as a minister for another few years.
Mm-hmm. You kind of mentioned a few of the people, but what were some of the memorable characters that that were housed in the Don?
Going back, one memorable case was the case of Carrie Davies. Now, this was in 1915, and she was a young serving girl, and she shot a member of the very powerful Massey family. She was his housekeeper or servant, I don't know what you would call her, and he made advances towards her, and she was terrified of the man, and she knew that there was a weapon in the house. She took the weapon, and when he came home from work one evening, she actually stepped out of the house and she shot him and killed him. And this was observed, you know, it was witnessed. So she was put in prison and she was tried for murder. She had a very good lawyer and she had a good case. You know, the lawyer presented the case that, you know, she was kind of stalked and she was vulnerable. And in fact, she was acquitted of this murder case. But for the 8 days and prior to that, as the case was moving through the courts, she was housed in the Don jail. Now, because of the fact that there were very rough types in the Don jail at that time, the matron in charge took pity on her and she was housed in the infirmary, not mm-hmm. with the general sort of jail population that kind of might have been quite hard bitten. She was 18 years old, very vulnerable. And she was acquitted. So at the end of all of that, she thanked the jail, she thanked her lawyer, she thanked just about everybody. And she was acquitted. So that was a very high profile case of somebody who spent time in the jail.
Now, you did mention a couple of the guys who did escape, but was it known for escapes? Were there any other major escapes other than the one in 1951-52?
Actually, one of the escapes that comes to mind and that's really one of my favorites took place in 1908, I think it was. And at this time, and really it was very embarrassing for the jail because at this time, as I said, the jail got very crowded and there was a lot of overflow and there were some sort of very kind of serious offenders being housed, awaiting trial, awaiting transportation elsewhere, housed in one of the corridors, very close to the execution chamber. And by some methodology or other, they managed to get the key to the execution chamber and they cut through. There were seven of them implicated. They were called very serious offenders and they managed to cut their way through the wall, 3 foot thick wall of the room. This is the execution chamber. They cut their way through the wall using the lever that was pulled when the gallows was activated. Mm-hmm. So they cut their way through and they escaped. And you know, some of them were apprehended again, but you know, this was a real scandal at the time. And that was, as I say, 1908.
That's crazy to use like the actual handle in the execution room. You think of people kind of getting out of their cells, but not the execution room.
Yeah, but as I say, they weren't actually in cells. They were in the corridor.
Right, yeah.
So that's what made it so easy. It was just the hardest part, I guess, was getting into the room.
That's amazing. So say you're arrested and you're tried and convicted and you're sent to the Don. What could you expect from the next few years of your life living at the Don?
You know, it was pretty tough in there. As I said, overcrowding was always a problem. So people were overcrowded. There were other problems there as well. You know, there were violent offenders housed there. It was kind of a holding tank in a sense. Mm-hmm. So violent offenders could be held there pending being moved to other facilities or whatever. So it wasn't a pleasant place to be in. There was there was disease, you know, there were mice in the place, there were rats in the place, and there was disease. So it wasn't a great place to be incarcerated in. And as I said, as time went on, it became more and more crowded. Mm-hmm.
And so it's become more and more crowded. You've had the escapes in 1951-52. Obviously, it's no longer a jail. So what led to its eventual closure as a jail?
So it opened in 1864 and it closed in 1977. Over the years, there had been a lot written about the jail, a lot of flak being directed against the jail. There had been complaints. For example, there were grand juries who had complained, grand juries had come in, who had examined the facilities of the jail, who had complained about the facilities of the jail, sort of how the prisoners were being treated. So that was one thing. Over time, there were reports. Excuse me. There was a royal commission in 1952 that spoke about the low staff morale and, so there were reports over a period of time, and there were the individuals who complained about it as well, ex-inmates, the press. The press wrote a lot about the conditions in the jail. So it was not doing well. Eventually, another jail, that was the old Don jail. So the new Don jail was built next to the old Don jail. And so a lot of the inmates were moved over to that facility. And then in December 1977, Frank Dre, who was then He was the Minister of Correctional Services. He announced that the jail was going to be shut down. And in fact, he wanted it to be pulled down and he wanted it to be turned into a garden for the benefits of the people at the nearby hospital. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it wasn't pulled down. There was a lot of public outcry because, it was an institution. And, what does one do with an institution, even if it is tainted? Should mm-hmm. you pull it down or should you not pull it down? So in fact, it wasn't pulled down, but it was closed in 1977, and then it just lingered on.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's a beautiful, from the picture behind you, it is a very nice looking building, so I can understand, both the historical aspect of keeping it, but also the aesthetic of the building as well, because, you don't get too many of those buildings anymore.
Yes, ultimately in the 2000s, it was brought into Riverdale. So there was a hospital at the back, and ultimately the hospital became Bridgepoint. And Bridgepoint, when they were building a new facility on that area, in that area, they sort of incorporated the jail, which was by then an historic building. They incorporated as their administration building. Yes, and also the public. It's open to the public, so the public can walk through. There's certain areas that you can walk through. They've retained some of the old cells. I sort of did a walk through. I was taken around the building by one of the staff there, and there are sort of hidden areas. For example, there's a computer room, sort of bristling with pipes and sort of other sort of computer equipment, and there are two old portraits, landscapes on the wall that were obviously painted by an inmate sort of way back. And in one of the offices upstairs, there's a big door, and when that door swings back, there are two of the old steel jails that were built when the jail was sort of repairs and sort of new facilities were added to the jail. So there are two of these old steel jails hidden behind this big door. So it's really a very interesting building, and the public is welcome. The public can wander through, and there are, you can pick up a pamphlet and sort of see some of the old jails, what they looked like, including those narrow ones that were so narrow that a fat horse couldn't be backed into them. So, it's a very interesting facility, but it's been beautifully redone. In fact, it was a prize winning mm-hmm. sort of restoration, but it's dark. It is dark. One can feel the history of the place.
Absolutely. And then people picking up the book, what do you hope they get out of reading the book and discovering the history of the Don?
You know, in the beginning, I ask certain questions. So one of the questions that I ask is, you know, it was built with such high hopes, with the reformist ideals, and with a great architect, and, you know, the sort of highest architectural principles. So the first question I ask is, what went wrong? So I hope that people, when they come to the book, will be able to get an answer to that. What went wrong? Other questions I ask is, did the jail protect the jailed and the jailers? Did it serve the city? I mean, the city started out as very small. You know, the jail was built to accommodate a population of 50,000 people. What happened? You know, mm-hmm. as the city grew, did the jail accommodate or did it not? And one of the questions that I asked was, what does one do with a tainted edifice when it's reached the end of its life? So I hope that people will get answers to those questions. Additionally, the Don jail is very different today after the heritage restoration. But, you know, as I said to you before, I think that darkness does still persist there. I do feel, mm-hmm. you know, it's very light and bright, white walls, red trim. It's very light and bright, but that darkness, I think, does exist there. And I remember, and in fact, I do quote in the book, I quote Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who said, every place where men have lived and died is a haunted place. So there are ghosts in the building. Mm-hmm. And the only way that one can recognize these ghosts and remember these ghosts is by having memorials, by keeping buildings, by having books. So in a sense, I'm hoping that this book will just help people to remember the Don and to remember the very vulnerable people who went through it, you know, the damaged people, the sad people, and people who were innocent mm-hmm. who went through the Don. So I think, you know, sort of the bottom line here is that I really want people to remember the Don. And in fact, that's what I term one of the chapters in the book, Remember the Don.
And then the last question is, for people who want to get the book, where can they get it? I guess most bookstores, website or anything like that?
Yes, I do have a website. It's www.lornapoplack, just first name, last name.com. And there is a link, there is a Don page, and there is a link on that page to various sites that it can be bought from. What I like to encourage people to do is to buy the book from their local bookstore, you know, just to support their indie bookstores. Mm-hmm. But if that is impossible, then of course it is available from the big players, from the Amazons, the Indigos. And I would encourage them, if they want to learn about the Don, to pick up the book.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. And if you did, please leave a rating and review. If you like, you can email me at craig@canadaehx.com. You can visit my website, where you'll find hundreds of articles on Canada's history, as well as all my podcast episodes. Just go to canadaehx.com. And again, you can support the podcast for as little as $3 a month. Just go to patreon.com/CanadaEHX, just like all of these wonderful patrons have. And I apologize if I mispronounce any names. Diane Wade, Lori Ann Kirby, Gary Dolovich, Nick Zinri, Pamela Elder, Shannon Marshall, Clinton Martinez, Dimitri Shove, Aaron O'Hara Myers, Robert Dunseith, Todd Casey, Catherine Rawa, Luke S., J.P. Bear, Jason Hall, Phil Maynard, and Iris Gray. As well, you can find me on Facebook. Just search for Canadian History X. Remember, that's EHX. I'm on Twitter. My handle is Craig Baird, CraigBaird. And don't forget, you can find me on Instagram. Just search for Bairdo37. Thanks, and we'll see you again next time.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone.
Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.